Hey everybody, and welcome to the latest oneliner.com podcast. I, as always, am an idiot coming to you from just outside Liverpool, and in Glasgow is site designer and editor Scott Morris.
Hello.
And in Brighton's in Falkirk is site contributor Drew Tavendale.
Hello.
We're going to be keeping it relatively short and sweet this week in comparison with our usual podcast, and we'll hopefully be coming to you a bit more frequently. So tonight we're going to talk about The Rocker, Burn After Reading, and Mirrors. So without further ado, let's get cracking on. Peter Cattaneo has done precisely bupkis since The Full Monty took the globe by storm. It took 4 years to follow that hit up with the underbaked, underseen and distinctly underwhelming Lucky Break, and 2005's Opal Dream was seen by one couple on a flight to Kathmandu and no one else. Now is the year of The Rocker, Cattaneo's latest attempt at sitcom cinema, this time revolving around a failed musician's hopes at hitting the big time 20 years after his first shot. Rainn Wilson, never heard of him in my puff, plays zealous drummer Robert Fish Fishman, who is jettisoned from 80s rock band Vesuvius, only to find himself enlisted by his nephew's high school band 2 decades later. Scott, if you have that time frame and swap the drum kit for the clapperboard, you could probably easily be talking about Cattaneo, could you not? And I threw you a curveball there.
You did, because I wasn't actually listening to you. Apologies.
Scott, tell us about The Rocker.
The trailer makes it look like an ill-advised mishmash of School of Rock, Josie and the Pussycats and Spinal Tap, and there's probably an element of truth to that. It's certainly wearing its influences on its sleeve, but what saves it is that it's actually quite funny. I mean, the lead role seems to be calling for Jack Black to be playing it. It seems to be the sort of role that gets written for him. However, in this case you've got Rainn Wilson, who's apparently the star of the American version of The Office. He actually does quite well. There's the odd moment in this where there's a bit too much reliance on a very broad humour of him basically getting drunk and falling over, and that's very much the least of the film, because a lot of the rest of it he's actually quite funny in, when he's making disturbing threats about attacking people like a rabid wolverine and chewing their face off. He's actually quite funny and somehow quite likeable as well, despite the fact that he's playing something of a jackass. The script's quite sharply written. There's some unexpected left-field humour, mainly from Fish's young nephew, Matt, who seems to have been scripted in ways designed purely to amuse only me. He will occasionally say things like, I don't know, it's just the cadence and kind of wording of lines like, I heart Matt LeBlanc from TV's The Friends.
Yeah, I did like the way he said The Friends.
So all in all, there's quite a good mix of broad comedy, which is less successful than the rest of its attempts, and there's some fairly cutting remarks, and it really is enough humour there to keep a wide range of audience types happy. Even, dare I say it, about a film where people bang their heads and fall over quite so often, there's actually some subtlety about it. The lead guitarist in the band and troubled singer with abandonment issues are quite clearly in love with each other, but it's not actually made a massive thing of in the script. It's only actually mentioned once explicitly at the end, and the rest of it's just really done through casual glances and that kind of thing. It's hardly Shakespearean, but given the sort of these kind of roles would normally be fit for overblown hysterics pretty much continually, it's a commendably restrained script. It's surprisingly enjoyable. The only other thing I've noted that I've really got to think about it is there's a cameo by Pete Best, who is perhaps better known as the drummer who was kicked out of the Beatles by their producer just before they recorded their first album, which has some fairly obvious parallels with the main story. All in all, it's surprisingly enjoyable. It's not a Spinal Tap, but then what is? It's a little bit derivative, perhaps a little bit over-reliant on broad body humour, but for the most part, I quite enjoyed it.
Well, at this point in the cinematic calendar, we'll take derivative if it's done reasonably well. I think, Drew, does this represent a step forward for Cattaneo and his craft over and above The Full Monty, which was, I seem to remember, inexplicably nominated for a Best Film Oscar, wasn't it?
I certainly know it was talked of a lot for awards, I think, especially in this country, largely because it was a British film that did quite well in America.
Woo!
Which kind of set it apart from so many others. But I was always massively underwhelmed by The Full Monty. I never saw Lucky Break, so I don't really know Cattaneo's work at all. No, not very well. And I was a bit apprehensive about this. As Scott said, the trailer made it look less than awesome. But the fact that the screenplay is written by a couple of writers, one who used to work, did a lot of writing for The Larry Sanders Show, and one who wrote a lot for The Simpsons, is always going to be have some promise. And yeah, it's nothing special, but it's pretty funny.
Fair enough, I suppose you can ask for very little else. Is it the funniest thing out at the cinema currently? Or would that be another film we're going to talk about tonight?
It would be, I would say, especially because that other film does have J.K. Simmons, which is makes it clearly superior.
See what I've done there, and yet another act of seamless linking. I'm going to go on to talk about that very film. God, we are getting professional. Recently, the Coen brothers seem to be adopting a pattern of alternating between award-baiting literary material such as No Country for Old Men and brief clutches of pseudo-farcical would-be comedy, such as their latest outing, Burn After Reading. Returning to original material for now, Burn appears to be a blend of the usual Coen black humour, interspersed with momentary violence and scatterbrained antics. CIA man John Malkovich quits his job after being demoted and decides to pen his memoirs, unaware that his divorce-seeking wife, Tilda Swinton, has been instructed by her lawyer to copy the material. Through a series of the expected left-field contrivances, the disc containing the memoirs falls into the hands of dim-witted gym employee Brad Pitt and his colleague Francis McDormand. Blackmail plots, accidental killings, and all other manner of loosely labelled hilarity ensue in the traditional Coen vein, but is it worthy of the legacy created by the brothers' earlier films, such as Fargo and Miller's Crossing, or is it, as some have claimed, a bland and unfunny misstep in an increasingly erratic career arc? Drew, I gather that you quite enjoyed Burn After Reading, but you're not quite made up on it yet, are you?
No, I would, before I speak anymore, would add the proviso that I did watch this, having had about 5 hours sleep over 2 days and the night before I went to funeral, so it's perhaps not the best condition I went in to watch it, and perhaps experience
overruled.
You think it ideal, do you?
Carry on, sir.
It certainly, I felt that it was quite slow in the beginning and perhaps into two minds as to whether it was going to be something of a thriller or a comedy, where later on it becomes that, no, we're just being a sort of farcical comedy. And it's certainly not bland though, and I can't decide whether I like it or not, but I'm going to watch it again and don't consider watching again a chore. So I guess that would suggest I did actually enjoy it more than I think I did.
Hmm.
It's not as good as the likes to say, well, Fargo or The Big Lebowski, if you're to compare it to their other work. And it's probably closer to The Lady Killers, but, you know, funny.
Yeah, quite a stark contrast there then.
Anybody liked other Coen brothers films, assuming they know them from everything pre No Country for Old Men, because that felt so different from pretty much anything else they'd done, it's likely to get something out of it. And the left field humour and awesome sights like John Malkovich deciding he's going to walk up the pier in his pyjamas and bathrobe carrying a hatchet to go and attack somebody, it can only be a good thing.
It's always a winner. Scott, I gather that you enjoyed this much more quantifiably.
I'm not sure about quantifiably. I mean, I was actually trying to write some sort of plot recap for it earlier, and I cannot for the life of me come up with an explanation of exactly why, what makes it so compelling. I think part of what I did like was the slowness, because it was a strange mix of, I don't know, it's like a cross between The Big Lebowski and The Good Shepherd or something. It does start off quite slow, and it's basically about paranoia creeping up from a fairly standard basic level through somewhere that's sort of almost justifiable to going completely over the top at the end. And I think it's just that the kind of gradual ramping up over the course of the piece that kind of got to me. I mean, I think the best comparison I can come up with actually is The Big Lebowski, because in the same way that The Big Lebowski is not really much of a plot in the slightest,
it's not particularly tightly plotted, is it?
No, is it? Here's a bunch of characters and just bounce them off each other for a while, and this is exactly the same thing. It's got the usual sort of Coen stamps, like little strange little running jokes that exist for about two scenes, like George Clooney's obsession with flooring and strange things like that. I wasn't particularly fawning over No Country for Old Men, so I guess this is where I get to say I think this marks a return to form for the Coen brothers.
Even though the rest of the world would disagree with us.
Yes, but they're wrong, as we've mentioned several times before.
Yay!
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly not as funny as The Big Lebowski, because it doesn't actually start off as a comedy. It starts off as something approaching a thriller, and it's only towards the end when it actually starts cranking itself up to 11 and past it that it starts getting really, really funny. And it seems like the whole point of the piece is that no one person in it actually understands what's going on at any point in it. I think it's essentially the point of the J.K. Simmons at the end, who's essentially explaining the film by going, don't know, let's move on.
Unless you sweep this under the rug next season. Just on that point, Scott, I would like to mention that J.K. Simmons in a film is nothing but a good thing ever, and all films should have more of him. Just a plea to the world. More J.K. Simmons, please.
I'm sure they're listening.
Yeah, all I can say is that I did actually very much enjoy this film. I mused it all the way throughout, and towards the end I was almost wetting myself with laughter, so I can't really go wrong with that.
I listened with interest to a few reviews on the radio I've heard, which all seem to be unanimous in their verdict of it seems to rely far too much on the lazy old sort of, oh, let's take George Clooney and make him ugly. Let's take Brad Pitt and make him ugly and stupid. Is that not something that it's guilty of?
I'm no judge of men, but I can't recall either Clooney or Pitt ever looking less than delectable.
Yes, absolutely. George Clooney, he's got a beard. Apparently, is that what makes George Clooney ugly? He's a beard. Otherwise, he looks like George Clooney's always looked.
Oh, fair enough.
I don't quite understand that comment.
Looks exactly like he looked in Syriana, but a little less haunted.
I think I've been the victim of a concerted misinformation campaign. I might give Byrne After Reading a try after all.
Presumably it's the same misinformation campaign that told everyone that No Country for Old Men had a fantastic ending rather than a totally shite one.
It's completely fucktarded.
Sorry, I didn't actually notice an ending on it. never mind. I just assumed that my copy had been cut off. But oh well, what do I know? What a surprise to find an Asian horror remake in the cinemas this week, yeah?
Really?
You don't get that very often these days, especially around Halloween. This time the source material is Korean flick Into the Mirror. And the man behind its rape and pillage is French would-be enfant terrible Alexandre Aya. Having previously established his chops with shite yet oddly revered by critics breakout title Hot Tension, aka High Tension, aka Switchblade Romance, make your mind up, Aya has since left his native shore and given us the Hills Have Eyes remake, and what a debt we owe him. This time he directs Kiefer Sutherland as disgraced cop on suspension Ben Carson, who takes up a night security job guarding a burnt-out New York department store, in which perished an improbable number of innocent peeps. It's not long before Ben is seeing things in the store's grand and strangely untouched mirrors, and subsequently suffering agonising living hallucinations of being burnt alive. Needless to say, his drinking habit is blamed for his visions, and his estranged wife soon demands he keep away from the kids. However, when the mirrors begin to take a foreboding interest in said sprogs, Ben decides it's time to go bandit, Reynolds style, and start finding answers as to just what these evil visions represent and why they are hounding him so. As with many of today's so-called horror movies, Mirror starts with a potentially intriguing premise and pisses it roundly down the pan within moments of setting it up. That old staple trick of making an innocuous, omnipresent, everyday object something to be afraid of is thrown to the wind, as Aya instead opts for his usual tactic of spraying the viewer with ridiculous quantities of gore from the outset. This serves the dual purpose of numbing the audience to subsequent atrocities, while pulling the rug squarely out from under any momentum of tension that may even threaten to gather pace. The rules of horror are deceptively simple, yet Aya, like so many of his contemporaries, seems more interested in engaging in a series of one-upmanship promoting set pieces that are no doubt fun for the effects technicians, not so much for the viewer. Mirrors subsequently ends up a sad reflection of today's horror output. Scott, back me up here.
Well, I think by this point we've reached the stage where we can simply say, this is a horror film, and then you can fill in the rest of the review yourself with about as many expletives as you can muster in any one particular sentence.
Can't you just?
Roundly terrible, although the thought of Jack Bauer attempting to waterboard confessions out of demonic mirrors was seemed quite an appealing one for some reason, but I don't know. Haunted mirrors. Pretty much says it all, doesn't it? He's getting attacked by haunted mirrors. Oh, I just don't see
haunted, haunted mirrors that I would like to point out can't follow the internal logic of the film.
Oh, no,
whereby at some points you must be standing in front of the mirror looking at it to be attacked. At other points, it can attack you pretty much any time it likes, yet chooses not to do so on other occasions.
What annoyed me more than anything else is by not even three quarters of the way through the film, it's not just mirrors anymore. It's specifically said at the start, he's being attacked by mirrors, and there's some sort of setup for why he could be getting attacked by these haunted, possessed mirrors, as stupid as it may seem. But
yes, not to ruin it for the listeners, but yes.
Well, it's already ruined by its simple existence. But things like, okay, well, after a while, it's not the mirrors anymore. The water's evil as well. By the end of it, the fucking doorknobs are evil and attacking people. What the fuck is going on in this film? It simply doesn't know what it's trying to do. It is throwing everything at the wall, and it's really quite sad when it is looking for its one big gore payoff where the where the jaw-ripping scene, which is alluded to in the trailers even, so I'm not going to spoil that, but it looks dreadful, and all of it looks dreadful, and it gets to the end, and the main bad guy could have come off of the evil fucking dead from about 20-odd years ago.
It's stupid.
Drivel.
What gets my goat as well is that it just seems to, at the point where he's like, oh no, now you're messing with my kids, it does sort of become like an episode of 24, except with mirrors instead of terrorists, and it resolves itself in just everything blowing up. which in a supernatural horror film isn't the sort of payoff I was looking for.
Yes, well, after Jack Bauer's dragged a nun at gunpoint to this hall of mirrors.
Look in the mirror.
Where is the president?
What year is it? I almost had hopes for this. Despite I criticise Aya for laying on the gore thick, but it's certainly not as bad as something like Switchblade Romance. There are actually only a couple of sort of gory set pieces, the most already infamous of which being I thought it was reasonably well done, the jaw-ripping scene. But it's scant consolation in the midst of, frankly, a fetid, steaming pile of horse cack such as this. It amazes me that as much praise as Aya may have garnered for Switchblade Romance, and whether or not you think he deserved it, surely playing off the back of that and aiming to actually head to Hollywood in order to do crap remakes of shit that nobody wants to see. Why is that such a lure to foreign filmmakers? They know what's going to happen when they get there. I mean, we spoke about this with Bangkok Dangerous the other day, didn't we, with the Danny and Oxide Pang.
I suppose the only thing I can think of is the money. I mean, have you seen his next project, which, or Sylar's next project or the one after, which is going to be Piranha 3D?
Yes, Piranha 3D.
That will be awesome, I have no doubt.
How my heart beats in anticipation for that one.
I can only hope that some people have seen the writing on the wall, at least. I noticed John Woo has gone back to China to do his Red Cliffs. There's a little war trilogy that's coming up, which I'm quite interested in. Hopefully we might actually review that next podcast.
Presumably the films The Wind Talkers should have been.
Yes. Although, I mean, of all the people that come over here, I guess John Woo's actually done slightly better. He's only made one really bad film. It was Payback. The rest of them are at least passable. But yeah, this film, no good at all.
No. Keep roundly away. Kiefer Sutherland. I don't know.
I don't know. Much as I like Kiefer Sutherland and I want him to be in good films, he never seems to do anything apart from 24 that's any good. He's done this and, what was it, Dark City, probably the last good film he's been in, I think.
You would think he would have the sort of clout to just sort of muscle his way into something that would be an obvious blockbuster by this point again, don't you?
Certainly after, what, six series of 24?
Yeah, six seasons of 24 and the seventh season being very hotly awaited.
Well, I mean, as producer on 24 as well, you know, and he's he clearly has the money now and the production moxie, so he could pretty much just set something up for himself if he wanted, I'm fairly sure, rather than burn his way into someone else's project. But I don't know, it doesn't seem to be happening.
Rather than make a film where you must seem awfully enthusiastic about painting over mirrors to stop evil getting out of it, because that makes a lot of sense.
Yes, exactly. The evil can't get out if you put on a base coat. That's the only reason why we're not being attacked by walls. I don't know. I certainly wouldn't recommend it. And my standards for horror movies drops ever lower by the day. I still couldn't recommend you go and see it. So I guess on... well, guys, if you had to pick one of the three to go and see this week, if I put a gun to your head, which of the first two would it be?
Born After Reading, without any doubt.
Yeah, I concur.
Well, there you go, folks. I myself cannot concur because I haven't seen it, but I might just go and catch up. We'll be back with you at some point in the very near future, hopefully, with another clutch of reviews. I, as always, have been Craig Eastman, and with me, as always, were Scott Morris.
Farewell.
And Drew Tavendale.
Goodbye.
Travel the safe path in the meantime, and remember to lock your door and shut your windows. Bye! That's going to be the next Alexandra Aya film podcast. Start talking back to people. Hey everybody, how's it going? We're fine.